You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Andrew.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I know your audio-only listeners won't be able to see this, but check out this sweet cup I got.
Ooh, Earthling mug. Looks like a going-away present.
I got to keep it center frame. Yes. I keep, you know, Karina kept on telling me because I was like, oh, I'm going to send a picture of our baby, whose name I don't say on podcasts. But, you know, you also sent us a going-away present, a onesie with a little Non-Zero logo on it. And she looks very cute in it. And then a few mugs. And Karina keeps telling me, send a picture of the baby in the onesie and say thank you. And I should have done that by now. So this is my official thank you for this very cool-looking Earthling mug.
Least I could do, Andrew. And for people who are completely disoriented, let me explain what you're talking about. So Andrew Day, until a couple of months ago, was part of the Non-Zero media empire. Mm-hmm. But now he's part of the American conservative media empire. Is it a senior editor or the senior editor at the American Conservative?
I say the senior editor, just because it
sounds
cooler.
What does the other senior editor say about that?
Well, there isn't another senior editor. I think Sumatra Maitra, who is a very smart guy, one of the writers on staff, he had been senior editor, and now he's kind of been unleashed as senior writer, and his work is worth checking out.
Are there junior editors?
There's not. We need some so that I can really elevate myself relative
if only for your self-esteem. I mean, what's the point of being a senior editor if there are no junior editors?
We do have like other junior editors. They just don't have that title.
What is their title?
I think we have like editorial fellows. So like people who are in college and they're kind of getting into journalism and they'll do like a second read for editing.
Do you have them fetch coffee?
I don't. I mean, I'm working remotely and they seem quite busy. So yeah, they're good.
Well, when you get a chance, have them fetch coffee. That's the kind of thing Trump would do, you know, to establish the hierarchy. And that leads us to our subject, I guess. Oh, yeah. I'm Robert Wright. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. I run the Non-Zero Newsletter. You know, it'd be fun to have Connor Eccles here, managing editor of the Non-Zero Newsletter. But you know where he is?
I do not. Where's he?
He's in Cuba. He's in Cuba.
Oh. Is that why you guys aren't doing an Earthling this week? I saw the note.
It's related to, yes, the two are related. It's kind of disappointing. I mean, on Friday, there was this big blow up with Zelensky and Trump, which is what you and I are going to talk about. So I figured, you know, Connor, being a good soldier, would say I'm on the next plane to Kyiv, you know, to take the pulse of the Ukrainian nation and write about it. No, he's going to the beach.
He's not doing any like recording there. That sounds kind of interesting if he
is. That's an excellent question. You should run a media organization.
Is this a vacation?
I forgot to ask that question. No, this seems to be a vacation.
Gotcha.
I don't know. I don't ask questions. I just, you know, people tell me what they're going to do and I say, oh, fine.
Well, I'm sure he would have had really insightful things to say about the Zelensky meeting, but I think maybe this dynamic will be more interesting because I'm imagining you're going to be critical of Trump and Vance's performance, but I'm kind of planning on defending it. I thought it was warranted what they did in that meeting.
Well, before we even get to that, I mean, we're also going to eventually get to the whole aftermath of this thing and like what the prospects are for peace. And a piece you wrote some time ago, not totally unrelated, you wrote it for the American Conservative before you were there, actually, about how Trump, whatever his feelings about the European may be, the European Union may be ideologically, and those are negative, he needs a united Europe. To, you know, execute his plan to kind of extricate America from the European security apparatus. As for who to blame, as you know, I'm not big on blame. I mean, I prefer to conduct my analysis without reference to that concept. Look, first of all, Zelensky has always been kind of edgy, you know? I mean, remember, it's funny. I listened to a podcast today that was taped right before this blow up. It was the War on the Rocks podcast. And the big subject was, oh, God, can you believe Zelensky insulted Trump? You know, it was the thing he had said about how Trump is living in a disinformation environment or something. And Trump replied with, you are a dictator, dickhead, being Trump. So, you know, Zelensky's, and just all along, he's always been, you know, he has struck some people as kind of demanding and not sufficiently grateful. He's always struck people that way.
And even Biden complained about that behind the scenes. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, if you watch the whole thing, you know, it kind of escalated. I don't know. Yeah. But it was not. Well, first of all, I want to say, I think it's not impossible that we'll look back on this and say, Zelensky, whoa, it's as if he was playing seven-dimensional chess. Because I think there's a way this works out well for him. A way. Hmm. Probably won't, but it could. You know, you got to remember that both he and Vance and Trump, they're all playing to their domestic audiences, for one thing. And that makes it hard for anybody to back down once things start to escalate a little. I also think there's a language problem. Like he, you know, English is not his first or second language. He doesn't speak it well. And, you know, the thing that the trigger when he said, so where is this diplomacy or whatever, you know, what kind of diplomacy, JD, are you speaking about after reviewing Putin's record? That I don't think was necessarily meant to be as challenging as apparently Vance took it as.
I think that's probably right. I mean, if I'm an expert on anything, it's listening to Eastern Europeans speak English somewhat haltingly. My wife is Russian and I have Russian in-laws. And it was clear that Zelensky was not fully comfortable speaking English. I mean, I do have, I think, two small criticisms of Trump that relate to the general context of the Oval Office meeting. But in general, if we're just talking about his performance and Vance's performance in the actual meeting, like starting at the beginning of the meeting up until when it gets tense, and then afterwards when Trump kind of adjourns the meeting and says, this is going to make great television, I think their performance during that time frame was probably necessary. They said what needed to be said. And I'm very skeptical of the consensus view in liberal media that this was like an ambush by Trump and Vance.
I don't think it was an ambush.
And even Friedrich Merz, the kind of chancellor in waiting in Germany, you know, he just won his center-right conservative party, just won elections. He's probably going to be the chancellor. He had that same view that he thought that this was an induced reaction, as he put it. And that to me doesn't really make sense. If you watch the entire meeting, it's pretty clear. You know, Trump was not only cordial. I mean, he was kind of rude when Zelensky first got out of the like black SUV and Trump kind of belittled him for not being dressed up. He said, oh, he's dressed up today, because Zelensky's not dressed up. He's mm-hmm. not wearing a suit. But during the meeting, you know, Trump was cordial and he was even quite restrained. And I had the sense that Zelensky he came in with the intention of undermining the Trump administration's diplomatic efforts. He even brought these pictures of these POWs mm-hmm. who had been tortured. And he showed those to Trump. He kept on Trump is kind of unique among Western leaders in doing this, but he often talks about how people on the Russian side and the Ukrainian side are dying, and that's got to stop. And Zelensky didn't take that well. He said, well, they're the invaders. They came to our country, to our homes. They started mm-hmm. this war. Basically, like, why does it matter if they're dying? So he kept on doing these things, sometimes subtle, sometimes not, that were plainly intended to kind of make it seem like the Trump administration's diplomatic efforts were wrongheaded. And eventually, obviously, it just blew up. I think by the time that Trump got agitated and kind of unleashed his like primal energy and was even getting physical with Zelensky and like shoving his arm a little bit, it made sense to me that he felt by that point that he really needed to shut this down and kind of put Zelensky in his place. I can talk about these two criticisms that I have, but what do you think about that general assessment?
Well, I don't think Zelensky was trying to undermine Trump's diplomacy per se. His big thing is he needs security guarantees.
Right.
He is insecure about any kind of peace deal that doesn't have troops from an allied country on the ground in Ukraine, for starters, and some kind of American support. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, what he was going on and on about. And you're right that in a certain sense, Trump was pretty patient. If you watch the whole thing, like Zelensky, it's like, let me show you pictures of Ukrainian POWs who have been abused. Let me, you know, it was really... He was on message from his point of view, and Trump pretty much let it go on. And honestly, I think Trump would have. J.D. Vance was kind of the accelerant. If anybody on the Trump side was an accelerant, it was J.D. Vance. And, you know, it was after Zelensky said that thing about diplomacy. And what he was, and even then, he wasn't saying, I'm against diplomacy. See, Vance had used the moment to do some political messaging and said, Biden is, Biden should have gone with diplomacy. Biden thumped his chest. That's what got you into this trouble. And of course, Zelensky can't quite accept that because he was there. You know, that's an indictment of him as well. And so he went on and on about how, look, Putin for the last 10 years was not abiding by his agreements. From Zelensky's point of view, that's the case. Mm-hmm. So he recited all that. And so I think he was kind of half saying, look, diplomacy would not have done it, but Biden and I did the right thing. Naturally, people say they did the right thing. And I think the subtext was kind of, you know, diplomacy that depends on trusting Putin is not going to do it in the future. That's his big message. You can't trust Putin. And look, anybody in his shoes would feel that way, I think. I mean, you're going to feel very vulnerable at the end of this thing. If you're Ukraine and you don't have something firmer than words on paper. And the U.S. doesn't, Trump doesn't even want to give that. In terms of a guarantee of American support. So, Zelensky, he was pushing the envelope for sure. And especially if you know Trump, which he should by now.
Right. Yeah, he seemed kind of weirdly unprepared to deal with the alpha male Trump. He had a very different approach than Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron had also met with Trump that week. And, you know, on certain occasions, they pushed back against J.D. Vance or against Donald Trump, but they did so with much more diplomatic finesse.
Well, English is their native language. I really want to keep him.
Well, not Macron.
That, but
Macron isn't totally comfortable in English.
No, he speaks it a lot better than Zelensky. But
I agree with that. But about Vance being the accelerant or accelerator, I think part of that was that he, unlike Trump, could see Zelensky the entire time. And a lot of what Zelensky was saying that I perceived as undermining diplomacy. And you're right that the reason he's doing that is because he wants security guarantees and he doesn't want to sign anything until he gets them. But he was kind of rolling his eyes. He seemed generally agitated. I thought he seemed exhausted, you know, understandably, obviously. And that was kind of manifesting like physically and his demeanor and his kind of physical responses to what Trump was saying. And so I think Vance was watching that, and eventually he just wanted to generally defend Trump's diplomatic efforts and the administration's diplomatic efforts. As far as security guarantees, I mean, one weird ambiguity in this meeting when reporters were asking questions is that they were often asking about the hypothetical peace deal, but the point of this Oval Office meeting, it was kind of like a formality before they would do a signing ceremony for this minerals deal. And I think one of the reasons Trump and Vance, et cetera, are getting annoyed by Zelensky's continued pushing for security guarantees, even though you're right that any leader in his position would be doing that, although I don't think quite as persistently as Zelensky is, but they're kind of thinking of this minerals deal as a security guarantee. And that seems kind of plausible to me. I think a lot of maybe left-leaning people, when they first heard about this deal, they thought, oh, it's a colonial plundering of Ukraine's resources.
But I think that was Trump's initial hope.
I mean, Zelensky originally floated the idea. He probably should have kept it in his back pocket because it sounds like Trump heard it and thought that sounded like a good idea. You know, obviously, we're kind of entering into this era where, you know, precious metals and minerals are kind of like the new oil and gas because, you know, lithium is needed to make batteries and copper is needed for technological products. And so America wants to make sure it has access to such things. And in the long list of like precious metals and rare minerals, Ukraine does have some. But if that's really what the Trump administration wanted, they probably would have gone elsewhere. I mean, by this point, it's become explicit. Trump has been willing to explicitly say the whole point of this minerals deal is to make us interested in Ukraine's continued stability because we'll have workers there, we'll have capital investment there, and we, you know, that'll give Ukraine the kind of guarantee that America cares what happens in Ukraine. But Trump doesn't want to do security guarantees and get drawn into a war with Russia. And probably Russia has such an upper hand in the war so far that they're not going to be, they're not going to accept any security guarantees that involve Western troops on Ukrainian territory or any sort of equivalent to NATO Article 5, where Western forces will come to Ukraine's defense if Russia invades. It seems like you want to say something in response to that.
Well, I mean, on the minerals thing, I mean, first of all, I had heard that Lindsey Graham actually encouraged it. And from his point of view, it was a way to get Trump to continue some arms deliveries beyond what is already authorized. So he was, I think he helped arrange the whole discussion of this thing. I think it doesn't amount to much. I mean, apparently in terms of accessible minerals, there's not all that much. And in any event, the deal they were going to sign, I gather, was pretty vague and really until they filled in some blanks that weren't filled in. I'm not sure really qualified for the term deal, but I hadn't thought of it as a form of security guarantee. I can see why Zelensky, given how vague it is, I can see why Zelensky doesn't feel super reassured by it. There's no guarantee in that agreement, I'm sure, that there will be American workers on site. And Zelensky knows that, in truth, it's not going to amount to much for years. So I don't see it as a big security guarantee. This question of what Russia will accept is fascinating to me because you're right. I don't think anybody's thinking about NATO membership. And I think any realistic person has to accept the possibility that formally taking NATO membership off the table will have to be part of a deal or may well have to be part of a deal. But I understand why Zelensky would really like some troops, even if only European troops that are a kind of tripwire, and ideally would like some kind of theoretical U.S. backstop of that. But the funny thing is, it's like the Russians are saying, no way, that's a non-starter. And some analysts are writing as if that's a given. Like I read something by Anatole Levin that seemed to go with that. Meanwhile, then I listened to the War on the Rocks podcast, and those guys are pretty smart. Ryan Evans, you know, and Michael Kaufman was on it, and Justin Logan from Cato and so on. And they're talking about the European troop thing. And first of all, Kaufman is saying, I've looked into this. It can happen. Europe can muster the troops. And in the entire podcast, nobody mentions the question of whether Russia will accept it. So, like, I don't get it. These people know more than I do, but they can't both be right. Either that, you know, we can assume for sure Russia would, or we can assume for sure Russia wouldn't accept it as part of a deal. Do you have a sense for, I mean, Russia is saying they won't accept it. Well, people say a lot of things when the negotiations begin.
Well, I know that in Hegseth's big speech at the Ukraine contact group in Brussels, and it was a very significant speech in which he basically articulated the Trump administration's, the kind of military dimension of their view of the multipolar world. Basically, we have to retrench from Europe. We can't really afford to subsidize your defense anymore. We're pre-notifying you, you know, we're not going to do this immediately, but you kind of got to get your stuff together because we want to focus on the homeland and core interests elsewhere. One of the things he said is that, you know, a connected point to what I just said is that Europe needs to take the lead in defending Ukraine and kind of guaranteeing its security. And he mentioned peacekeeping troops. He mentioned European and non-European peacekeeping troops. And by that point, it was obvious he doesn't...
Hegseth mentioned that?
Yeah. And by that point, it was obvious that that did not mean American troops. They were not included in the non-European peacekeeping troops. And so I thought that was interesting because, you know, by that point, Trump has already been talking to Putin on the phone, and they're kind of preparing for talks in Riyadh. And I sort of thought he wouldn't have said that if they had assessed Russia's not going to accept
that.
Well,
I mean, look, you know? I think the situation's fluid. I think it's not determined. I mean, when you look at the amount of leverage America has, there's a ton of stuff we could give Russia if this really is a sticking point in exchange for living with 10,000 troops from France and Britain or something in Ukraine, you know, probably not too close to the Russian border.
The Kremlin has said they don't want any troops from NATO countries on Ukraine. The Kremlin, that is the Kremlin's official position. Yeah. Maybe they can be bargained out of that, but that is what they say.
I think, you know, in general, I have some criticisms about how much Trump is saying out loud before the negotiations have started. But I will say that this is a good thing for Hegseth to say, I think, for to say, look, our opening position is there's going to be troops there. OK, that Ukraine should be happy about that. Ukraine shouldn't be happy about them saying out loud and Ukraine's not going to be part of NATO. Now, it may be that Zelensky is to blame for Trump giving away some of this negotiating leverage by saying too much out loud, because Zelensky seems like, what's it going to take to convince him of a few hard facts, right? It's like, I guess you got to say it publicly before he'll start thinking it's real, you know? So
yeah, I agree. I had the same assessment, because, you know, on the campaign trail, Trump was saying, well, you know, I'll get a deal. I'll tell Zelensky, I'm going to cut off aid. If you don't make a deal, I'm going to tell Putin the aid's going to keep going to Ukraine if you don't make a deal. But I think it's turned out to be kind of difficult to negotiate this publicly, because you can't do everything behind closed doors. You kind of have to articulate your position. And he, you know, he has said on numerous occasions, including in the Oval Office meeting, that we are still giving weapons aid to Ukraine and we will continue to do so. But I think they're getting annoyed that that's enabling Zelensky to keep on, you know, being kind of bold in his and his demands. And then, you know, one other option in terms of security guarantees that I kind of want to put on the table, because I think it's interesting, is the notion of armed neutrality. Emma Ashford of the Simpson Center recently had a piece in Foreign Affairs about this. And basically what it amounts to is building up Ukraine's military so that going forward, it can kind of guarantee its own security. It'll become like a very prickly porcupine that Russia's not going to want to swallow. But even doing that is going to require some negotiations, because Russia's going to want caps on Ukraine's military. And so they're going to have to work out what all Ukraine is allowed to have. They're probably going to have to convince Russia to, you know, consent to a peace deal that involves Ukraine having a lot of defensive weaponry that they can use in case Russia invades again. And Europeans are talking about that too. I mean, armed neutrality is something that the Europeans are talking about with Ukraine this week, but they're just adding this extra thing that they'll have European troops with an American backstop, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, the line between offensive and defensive weapons gets pretty blurry as a rule, and that's one of the problems with, with, you know, it gets back to the security dilemma and, you know. But, yeah, you know, armed neutrality makes sense. I mean, I think, well, first of all, I think an American backstop, if you really had French and British troops and maybe Turkish troops, like in any kind of numbers, that's a pretty serious tripwire. Not that either country would be sure to come to Ukraine's aid as opposed to evacuating troops if Russia invaded. It's just that it's hard for Russia to be sure that they would chicken out, right? So I just don't see Putin anytime soon. You know, look, if he gets a deal that starts integrating Russia back into the Western economy and so on, I don't see him wanting to cause trouble anytime soon, period. And I certainly don't if there's French and British troops in Ukraine. So this business about the U.S. backstop, I mean, it sounds like it's going to have to be abandoned. And by the way, I think from Trump's point of view, that could be a way of kind of saving face or, you know, well, on the one hand, continuing to support Ukraine with weapons and stuff. But on the other hand, kind of conveying that he did slap Zelensky down, that he won the Oval Office encounter, is like if he comes out now and says, look, I will talk to Zelensky when he quits talking about this backstop thing, because until he accepts that, I'm not going to talk to him. And then Zelensky, you just shut up about it and they can start talking. And Trump would be like, I won. I'm the dominant male. And then he could continue to, you know, supply arms and stuff without fear of, you know, his fragile ego sustaining any damage. But
I mean, I don't think that wouldn't just be like an illusion. You know, he would indeed have succeeded. and kind of browbeating Zelensky into submission. And that's, I think that's clearly what the Trump administration feels that they need to do. You know, everyone is saying this explicitly at this point, but it's been obvious for a while, even back to that dust up where Zelensky said Trump is living in a disinformation space. And then Trump came out and said all this stuff about how he's unpopular in Ukraine and he's a dictator. Yeah, that was my impression all along. And now even like National Security Advisor Mike Waltz is saying it publicly that they think that Zelensky's political motives and personal motives are just kind of opposed to pursuing a peace deal at this moment. You know, previously they had been trying to convince him to do so. Now they're saying, well, you can just come back when you're ready to play ball. But we don't want to continue
again,
this war anymore.
Think he's, I think he'd have to be clinically insane to not be seriously entertaining a peace deal at this point, given the situation on the battlefield. But I do think he wants to get the most he can get in the way of security guarantees. And I understand that he doesn't consider words on paper enough. Who would? I mean, who, this is a problem with American foreign policy, is the wild gyrations between presidential administrations mean that basically nothing we say about long-term commitments carries much weight with anybody. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, David Sacks had this this post, you know, he's the crypto czar. Did you fail to buy crypto before the announcement, by the way,
that the government is going to invest in these companies?
It's like,
do you know, I mean, I don't know much about it, so I don't really want to say anything about it, but do you know, is he personally invested in these crypto coins that
he
are
says
now-
he personally is not. Some people said they think some of the startups he backs have an interest in this. I don't know. But I think when he became crypto czar, if he had any crypto, I do believe he sold it. But anyway, so he starts out saying Zelensky's meltdown in the Oval Office began over his refusal to accept a negotiated settlement to the war. Even the vice president's use of the word diplomacy provoked a heated response. Again, I think that's a misreading. I think Zelensky just meant, look, you can't take Putin's word. We need troops on the ground. But then he goes on to talk about this Time magazine piece, David does, where some aides to Zelensky are quoted as saying he's, or at least one is anonymously quoted as saying that Zelensky's belief in ultimate victory over Russia has, and now he's quoting from the Time piece, hardened into a form that worries some of his advisors, according to Time magazine, which describes Zelensky's face as immovable, verging on the messianic. According to one of Zelensky's aides, quote, he is delusional. We're out of options. We're not winning, but try telling him that. I mean, I wonder if that's true. That would be kind of disturbing.
That seems to comport with his behavior in this past week. I mean, well, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. Like any leader in his position would be saying, let's get security guarantees, that kind of thing. But one, you know, the Trump administration is saying this is part of a sequence. Like we'll do the minerals deal first. We'll kind of work it out later, the details, but basically that's just getting us more enmeshed in Ukraine so we have an interest there. And then we'll try to get a ceasefire, and then we'll try to get some sort of peace deal where we think about security guarantees at that point. And that's what Trump was saying in the meeting. And they were basically saying, your best interest right now is to stop the bullets from flying. You have no leverage vis-a-vis Russia because they're winning on the battlefield. But now that we're restarting dialogue with Moscow and we're kind of doing this on your behalf, we can get to a ceasefire that you probably couldn't given your lack of leverage. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why he would blow up that meeting given that circumstance. Like your most important ally.
I don't think he chose to blow up the meeting. I don't think he chose to blow up the meeting.
Why didn't he just sit there and smile and not kind of publicly disagree?
I don't know, but
diplomacy.
He wasn't doing it from the very beginning. He's like that. He's like this. But if you look at what his obsession was, it was security guarantees. It was mm-hmm. like American backstop. That's his mission in the Oval Office. It's pretty clear if you watch the whole thing. And he didn't. One thing, you know, you're right that he was edgy. He sometimes is like that, seems agitated. There's been speculation I won't get into, but he did not raise his voice He did not raise his voice. Vance raised his voice. And then when Zelensky referred to Vance having raised his voice, Trump started screaming at Zelensky for saying that Vance raised his voice. But Vance did raise his voice. Vance escalated. I think Vance sensed the moment. Like, Trump hadn't quite turned it adversarial, but he could tell he's getting upset. And I think Vance, whom in general I don't have super high regard for, is good at sensing these kinds of political moments and sensing when it would be fine with Trump if he shifted into a higher gear, which I think he did. I really don't think Zelensky was just, well, yeah, he should not have challenged. I mean, he shouldn't have said to Vance, you know, can I? And he ended it politely. He said, can I say something, JD? And sure. And then he goes into the diplomacy thing.
He was trying to needle him a little bit. I mean, he was needling him. It wasn't just like an open, objective discussion. Like when he said, have you been to Ukraine that you know what our situation is? I mean,
yeah, that's true. That was it.
In one sense, it's like a fair question to ask behind, but it's a rhetorical question that he knows Vance hasn't been, you know.
Pushing the envelope. But, you know, another thing he's probably thinking is, you're not even fucking president, man. You're younger than I am.
That is exactly what he was thinking.
It's like, I'm talking to the president. I am the president of a war-torn country, and I've probably shown at least as much courage as you would have. I mean, that's what he's thinking. And it's like, and I'm talking to the president of the United States, and you're this little kid, shut the fuck up. Which is the way I feel about J.D. Vance. And you can tell him that if you ever see him.
But I don't know. To me, it seemed like J.D. Vance, I'm calling him J.D. because Zelensky did that. And it kind of stood out to me when he used his initials like that. But I think what happened is J.D. Vance could see his physical reactions to Trump. Like, as I said, and he felt, okay, I got to step in because it seems like we're getting kind of publicly undermined by our client. This relates actually to the two criticisms I have of Trump that relate to the context of the meeting. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, this event, as I said, this meeting was supposed to be a mere formality that preceded kind of closed door communications, like a lunch where they would probably talk about the details of the minerals deal and then a signing ceremony for the minerals deal. But I don't know if you've seen this stat where Trump has answered significantly more questions from reporters, obviously, than Biden. But even compared to like his first administration and Obama, he's answering like a lot of reporters' questions. One of the reasons for that is these kind of ceremonial meetings in the Oval Office used to be purely ceremonial. Like they would be very short. Mm-hmm. They would just be the president and the foreign guest kind of reaffirming the closeness of their relationship. Then they would kind of gesture that they might take questions and reporters would shout like shrieking monkeys. And then maybe the president would see a question that was worth answering and say something. And then they'd wrap up the meeting and then they'd go argue. But I think Trump, to draw a contrast with Biden, you know, he wants to be seen as like answering all these questions and kind of holding court publicly. But the divergence in interests between these two nations, Ukraine and the U.S. right now, made it so that was just kind of unworkable in this particular meeting. Like, there's not much that they can say that's not going to piss off the other person, Zelensky and Trump. Mm-hmm. And so eventually it just kind of got out of control.
Yeah. No, the guy's edgy, there's no doubt. Before you make your second point, how about if we go into overtime?
Yeah, let's do it.
So overtime is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. Easy to become one. And wouldn't you say that that's a worthy cause, Andrew?
It is. Everyone should subscribe. Actually, I think I need to get a paid subscription now. I realized that I was paywalled out the last time I went to the Earthling.
We're ready to accept your credit card information, Andrew, whenever you want to bring that thing. I mean, hey, we gave you a mug, okay?
I went to read the thing that Connor, I guess, wrote about this life longevity guy.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever his name is. So, yeah, that's when I saw the paywall.
Brian Johnson, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, that's in the Non-Zero newsletter. One of many reasons to go there. Pause and read that piece while you're becoming a paid subscriber so you can listen to this and to all the overtimes, have special podcast feed. Automatically gives them to you, other bonus content and so on, plus supporting a worthy cause. Okay, so in overtime, I'm also going to explain how this could be seven-dimensional chess on Zelensky's part, but almost certainly isn't. But in theory, could be. Okay, so thanks to everybody who's stayed with us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime.